Welcome to a new episode of Product Directions Podcast, 100 Product Strategies. We are your insider access to top product leaders shaping the strategy of the most diverse industries today. I'm your host, Nacho Vassino, and I'll be digging into the real-life situations, problems, and frameworks used for strategy with product people all around the world in all kinds of products and markets. While there is no recipe for success, listening to others' experiences may give you the edge you need to solve your next strategic challenge. Hello, everyone. Welcome to a new episode. Today, I'm really glad because I'm with Stefan Schnabel, who is a senior product manager at Google and has a very interesting past at interesting companies. So we'll explore a bit of that as well. Stefan, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Nacho. I'm super glad to be here.
All right. So I would like always to start by having you introduce yourself a bit better than I did. Can you give us a bit of your background and what you have been doing lately?
Yeah, definitely. As you mentioned, I'm a senior product manager at Google. I've been in the product field for about 15 plus years now, which always amazes me. It's not something that I anticipated. I spent the last 12 years at Google in various product areas and working on various products that included Google Ads, Google Analytics, Google Search, as well as Google's hardware products. And most recently, I'm working in internal tech education. And so I'm the global product lead for educating Google's tech workforce. Prior to Google, I actually was a software engineer at Goldman Sachs in London, where I was working very closely with traders in the business side to build tools and trading applications to run the business. My background's in computer science and statistics, and I'm originally from Salzburg, Austria. So, central Europe, I suppose.
Yeah. That's great. And actually, this episode is a bit special because we discussed basing it on an article you wrote, but I think the context on which you were starting creating this new strategy for your team was a bit special. So can you give us a bit of a background in which where this strategy story started?
Yeah, absolutely. So my current team that I work on or that I work with here at Google is a team that is really focused on helping professional individuals learn. And I think education is a very specific use case for software technology products. I've always been very fascinated with how software can support various pockets of the world, especially education. And so when I joined this team about, it's coming up to close to 2 years now, 2 years ago, I was really humbled by how challenging it is to identify where software can support education in a effective way, in a scalable way. And I think we all know that from various experiences we probably had ourselves. A lot of courses went online. A lot of us went to college maybe just at the time where using technology became mainstream. But mostly education still happened in sort of classroom fashion. And so pairing up, Google's DNA, which is highly scalable software products, with a use case such as education, was really a sort of net new thing for me, a net new challenge for me. And so I quickly realized you couldn't go at it with the regular strategic approaches that I had been practicing in products at Google, such as ads or search, which are, highly successful highly scalable software products. And so that really triggered rethinking what type of strategy could I apply to work with a reasonably small team serving a larger, significant user base and achieve disproportionate success.
Yeah, yeah. And maybe a question to that, because I think it's the selection of the use case is quite important piece of the puzzle. Did you have any impact from the larger Google strategy when deciding, okay, what's my playing field? So because as I said, education, it's super, super, super broad. So you can find multiple different use cases there. So what was the interaction between you exploring the field versus the company priorities?
That's a really critical question, and it touches on a big part of what the team and I had to work through over the course of, you know, long days and a lot of hours. For that answer to make sense, you're going to understand that at Google, a lot of people are involved in something education. Google has educational efforts within their various product areas, like GCP. Google also has its own product area that is purely focused on education. And then it also has a ton of people in the research side also involved with education. And so there is a massive space and spectrum that Google is covering when it comes to education. Now, that is on one hand great, and it's certainly something I really cherish about the company I work for, that they really invest in that use case. I do think it's a critical one for Google, but also for the broader ecosystem and maybe even for the world. Mm-hmm. But it also requires to think deeply about what you just highlighted, which is what is the space we wanna work in? What's the space in which we try to create market fit to find a product opportunity that really helps users, that really answers a problem? So what happened there was that the team really looked long and hard at its own identity. And one thing that was actually quite helpful was that the group that I joined had previously been in research. And what that meant is that they were very, very well equipped with the academic foundations of learning use cases. So everything from the right metrics to the right formats to just what makes learning work from a human and a sort of almost this psychological point of view. Now, equipped with that knowledge, they were actually moved into a different part of the company. And that part is called core. And in that part, what they really started to think about was, how can we make our experience, our expertise work for our tech workforce? And so those are individuals that are in a tech role at Google. So typically, those would be software engineers or developers, product managers also, and technical program managers. And also UX designers would fall into that category too. And so we had to rethink essentially our problem space. And the approach that we took, and we'll talk about that in more detail as well, really started with thinking about how can we draw a much narrower circle so that we can actually control complexity. And that was really a big starting point for us. And we did draw circles around our developer workforce, for example. So that was one very bright line. And it was not to forever make that the wall, right? This was truly to ensure that, as you indicated, we wouldn't start spiraling where we wouldn't focus enough, we wouldn't be able to filter enough the ideas that the teams came up with, so that our small team actually had a chance building out something concrete that had value. And that was certainly going a little bit beyond strategy and into the team's working culture. The working culture coming from research was very much one of finding problems and spaces and describing them very accurately. But it wasn't necessarily required to build product in them. Yeah. And so one organizational cultural transformation we had to do was to say, well, it's one thing to have ideas in a space, but we also need to think through how we're going to build an effective product strategy in that space. And so, it took a while to collaboratively bring everyone along, but we developed 5 principles that we used to really define the space in which we wanted to come up with a winning product and with product market fit.
Yeah. And can I, so I have so many questions, but I will just ask you to do that. Can you share some of those principles or?
Yeah, 100%. So the first one, as I mentioned, was we did focus predominantly on the developer workforce. And there's a couple of reasons for that. First, they're the biggest cohort within tech Googlers. Secondly, they're very opinionated. And thirdly, they're also a role within Google that we know we had direct access to. We could, talk to them, speak with them. They're part of our own teams, right? And, yeah. And certainly that made everything very easy.
Small the question second, to that.
Yeah.
When you say focus in this case, it's like we have our product available for the outside world, but we focus on this audience, or it's more like we are deploying internally limited to this, because in this case, you can actually limit the access to it, right?
So at the highest level, I think there was another principle that you're calling out that I haven't mentioned that already was sort of an agreed upon principle was that we decided to focus the work that we would do on internal only. And while that is not the limit of what the team's doing, our team also has products in market that go that serve users outside of Google. It certainly is a bright line in many ways, like data access and what can be tracked and how to deploy even the technology stack underneath. And so we did decide to make that a first principle. Right. Also, because that is a big part of the mandate of the group that I work in right now.
Sorry, I interrupted. I was going to tell the second
one. Yeah, no worries. So the second principle was to focus on learning journeys. So that sounds a little sort of trivial, but there's tons of journeys that people have that are more of an automation or productivity increase type. And they often get confused with learning journeys. So it's sort of, someone wants to do something and then they get a helper. They get something that automates that step for them. Now, that is often taken as if it would essentially help people also understand what they were about to do. But again, those things aren't the same. So we really wanted to focus on learning journeys over journeys of automation and other such things. Now, that's also really critical because for our strategy, we always needed to make sure we could articulate why we needed to own it. There's tons of teams at Google who do automation. There's tons of teams at Google who build workflow tools, especially for software engineers. And we needed to make sure there was a pretty bright line between what they are doing and what we are doing. And so that was really helpful. The third principle was to focus on automated approaches. And so, as I mentioned earlier, a big part for us and for our strategy was scalability. It wouldn't help us to create a one-off example of something that would work and would have big benefits, but, we would punt on scaling that later because clearly in this climate as it is today in tech, there's way more scrutiny on this type of approach. And frankly, with our team size, we always knew that that wouldn't be an option. And so those are three of the principles. A fourth one was that we also focused on existing surfaces. And so that was also a pretty big cultural shift, but just product strategy shift. Previously, the team has been working on building out surfaces such as an app or an internal site, and then distributing that destination to users in the hope that those users would convert onto that surface and then go through the product experience. What we came to believe is that for internal users, the burden of yet another surface they could go to is extremely high. And so we really needed to focus on the tools that our users would currently using and wondering about what learning journeys do they have and how do those surfaces play a role and how can we better leverage those existing surfaces.
That's a pretty good one. That's a very interesting. I hope that we have some uncover some stories for that principle. But tracking back to what you were saying, the story you were sharing. So my first question was around how the company define the group focus. And if I can summarize that, it's like the team shifted from a research environmental research team towards this core group. So the mission of the core group kind of was defining the mission of this learning group. Was that appropriate approximation?
Yeah, that's appropriate. So I do think the the group that we joined was really focusing on improving the life of developers inside and outside of Google. Now, one wrinkle in all of this is that our group is certainly it's not a true concentric circle style organizational setup, which is an imperfection. Ideally, I know the theory, right? So you would love that, you know, a sub team's scope is completely encapsulated in the product area scope that they're a part of. So you don't want anything sticking out, basically. And so in our case, our group's mission is to educate technical audiences effectively and at scale. And I do think that is going a little beyond what I think sometimes the developer nature constitutes, right? We certainly serve other user groups as well. But in principle, that is a good alignment.
Yeah. I mean, just to have an idea on the organization itself, this core group, what other teams are there or what other functions do you serve as well?
Yeah, so I mean, there are teams that serve our developer group. So, for example, there is truly a team in there that's called Core Developer.
Okay.
And that group is really anchored on developers that work at Google, but also developers that work with Google's developer tools, right? Google has a huge host of developer tooling. They're called third-party developers, and you know they have a ton of products in market for that group as well. And, there's also teams in that group that build workflow tools. So tools that help our developers or other teams at Google, build software. And some of these tools are also externally available. And so there are also groups in there that build proprietary technology. So technology that help our teams build, safe software for the world, essentially.
Perfect. Yeah, that makes sense. So that's very interesting. So it's a part of a very comprehensive set of helps for developers.
Maybe, I mean, honestly, one comment on this. I do think a group that really focuses on learning, it is really hard to place that in a tech company such as Google. It's really hard to find a home that sort of ticks all the boxes. And I do think that's just because it is quite difficult to not make learning go broad or limit the application of learning, right? I do think learning happens in a lot of places. And in some ways, you just discover where it happens and when it happens. And sure, everyone's craving the sort of clarity of work alignment and mission alignment and so on. But in some ways, I sometimes find, what if we discover that, helping learning for 3P developers would be the place where it's at? Should we not do that? Or just because we're in that org? I do think we can retain a little bit of that freedom, if you want, from our research times, you know, to be able to raise a hand and say, you know, we have an opportunity over here, and can we exploit that opportunity if the value and is big enough?
I love that, because usually what I say is that you as a team have a responsibility to, I would say, challenge the strategy, but it's not challenging for the sake of challenging. It's kind of this sort of learnings that the team can uncover that are probably far away from what the management, for example, might be thinking. But by bringing these opportunities, you may kind of shift their thinking and help them kind of have a more comprehensive strategy. So that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, exactly.
And then that's, I think, a good segue to the next question, because actually, well, I want to jump into how formulating this strategy. So you have a bit of a shift, kind of going to another organization or changing groups, as you said, and you need to formulate the product strategy with this new focus area. So what do you do first? What's the first step in saying, okay, we will go in this direction, but what do you start doing?
Yeah, so the first thing was for us clearly to take inventory. Where are we? What people do we have? What experience do we have? What, you know, problem experience do we have? Like, you know, to your earlier point around, you know, the principles, and I shared some of them. What experience do we have in any of these principles, right? How many people know about automated approaches in the space of learning? How many people know about the user touch points? Even if we limit the user base to developers, you know, who has that experience and what level of experience do we truly have here? Yeah. I think another slightly orthogonal thing that we also did was take inventory on the areas of investment that we were running on at that moment. You know, are some of these current products really as impactful as they could be? Do they have longevity? What business value are they generating? And so we did that because we had a newly found set of principles for our product strategy, and we didn't want to measure, you know, with two, we didn't want to apply two different yardsticks here in some ways, right? We wanted to have a sort of fair approach in that way. But we also did that because we felt we needed the resources, honestly. And so we looked at some of the products that the team worked on that were more anchored on research principles. And we decided to put them in a maintenance mode. You know, they're still valuable and still useful, but we decided not to innovate on them anymore. And instead really start from a first principles point of view. And that then really shaped the actions we took. So, you know, for example, as we thought about what are the interaction points of our users across our existing surfaces, we did a host of 25 talks. We facilitated 25 talks from people across the company to explain to us how their surfaces worked and who visited their surfaces. And we digested, you know, per surface, per talk, we had, you know, 3, 4, 5 research artifacts that we digested as a group on, you know, what are the users that go there? Why are they going there? What is the experience that can help us understand the learning user journey? Thanks. And that certainly on that one dimension, that was a very critical action because it helped level set the team's understanding, right? Sort of like, okay, what are we dealing with here? And we did that on many levels, especially the automated approaches also, right? We had some people that were familiar with models that could classify, models that could leverage large language models, for example. And we needed to make sure we had that knowledge shared across the team. So when we speculated about which product might be having the highest probability of success, which product idea might have the highest impact on the user's problem, that we had the right knowledge in the room.
Yeah, that's very interesting. So I will split into questions, because that's the first one is maybe not a question, but summarizing what you said is like taking inventory, so trying to see what's the situation out there, which means that we have some things that we will stop working on, but some things that are more relevant now and have opportunity for improvement. plus the, I would call it the discovery side of things, in which you were kind of going through your audience, your target user, and trying to kind of experience what opportunities were laying there. On the second part that you mentioned, or the last piece, how do you deal with content as a learning group, a teaching group in this case? Because I assume that you need to enable the learning experience, but then there is content that or expertise that you need to convey or put out there for learning that is not in your team itself. So do you work with, you know, either providers, or how that interaction works?
Yeah, that's a great question. So ultimately, a part of the group that I work with is a group of tech writers and learning designers who create content. So we actually do own a significant portion of learning content. We also own a large portion of essentially the knowledge of learning content that's out there. But then also we have a system internal to Google that's almost like Google search, but just for internal documents. So it is not difficult to find or retrieve learning content. Now, having said all of that, what is challenging is to understand when documents are missing or when documents aren't of a high quality. And so that's certainly an ongoing technological challenge, right? So not every document has the right metadata. Not every document was written to convey knowledge. Some documents are really good, but they're hard to parse, right? That's a common occurrence in a tech world.
Yeah.
I also want to say one thing around the environment that we're playing in, and I think that is really critical. In learning and software in learning, I see two archetypes of a sort of software space or a product space. And the one archetype is what I call the walled garden environment, and that's your Duolingo or your Khan Academy. Those are apps or environments in which everything's tightly controlled, and every piece of content was created with a certain level and a certain state of the learner in mind. And those environments are incredibly effective when it comes to the application of software systems, right? So, for example, language learning is a place where if you leverage an app, the tailored experience you get, your learning path is measurably more effective than a one-size-fits-all learning path, right? That is a very rare occurrence in a way, because that happens without the intervention of a human.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the prerequisites for that is that walled garden nature. It is that control over every little item in there. Now, when we are talking about the environment that the team and I are operating in, that's what I refer to as a chaotic environment. Yeah. Chaotic because there's no equality in anything, really. we have all kinds of modalities, all kinds of documents, all kinds of metadata. Nothing's really written to be leveled, right? But we also have documents that are leveled. We have documents that are written by highly skilled professionals that wanted to create them for the purpose of learning. So we have a much richer degree of diversity in every aspect, the half-life of content and everything. And so the technological approach is disproportionately more complex, and the product strategy that is required to place a winning product in that space is very different from what you would consider in a more walled garden environment, where you have way more control over the individual factors that determine learning.
Yeah, got it. That's very interesting, I guess. But I can actually make it to my next point with that one, because my next question is, okay, you have group a host of opportunities from kind of taking inventory, talking with users, but now probably you have more things that you can actually cover. So how do you go into assessing those opportunities and selecting the most critical ones to actually not at the tactical level, but more of the strategy level? So how do you select the areas in which you will focus?
Yeah, definitely. So we did, we did go through this, and it was an interesting experience because we created this framework. We called that framework Pilots. And it was certainly an incarnation of a rapid iterative product discovery strategy. And in that product discovery strategy, we really had to operate at pace at every level. So at the strategic level, all the way down to the tactical execution. And a big part of the effectiveness of that strategy did rely in communicating our ideas about the phases that we would go through and what they meant, what it meant for selection, how selection would occur, what it meant, what good meant in some way, but also the inclusion of everyone that was involved and bringing them along. And certainly that was a big sort of monumental effort. And so I was extremely happy working with a team that was so receptive to this, right? Because their creative energy was so strong. They were so interested in essentially getting started, right? Yeah. And they didn't want to sink energy into something that they had the feeling wouldn't be a winning strategy anymore. So one thing that's more on the strategic level is that we formed a council, and that council was essentially determining a rubric with which we would look at different suggestions mm-hmm. and different pilot ideas, and we would evaluate those pilot ideas. And it was not to judge these pilot ideas. I think it was more a matter of making sure that questions were asked that were in spaces that clearly, you know, folks on the team might have not asked yet. And it was an attempt to share accountability around placing resources ultimately into certain ideas, right? We never wanted to create the situation where people ideated, brought forward pilot ideas, and then had the feeling that late in the game they learned that, oh, this is actually not strategically important. So yeah. The council consisted of senior folks cross-functionally, and we also created repeat check-ins, so almost sort of like standing product review schedule with the senior leads in the organization. So we communicated the process, we communicated the dimensions by which we would evaluate, we communicated the rubric, the weight of those dimensions, all the way up to the VP level, and made sure that people looking at this would then be okay if the team's self-selected or self-proposed pilots, because they knew the scoring would fall out positively for them, right? So it was really a way to equip, to give the rod, not the fish, and to help the team sort of like self-select. We also created phases that we push these pilot ideas through. Sort of like a funnel, if you want, where we had, you know, broad ideation at the beginning. We then had a more, you know, clear articulation of the core hypotheses and so on. And then a moment in which we would allocate resources toward that pilot to create structured research to identify evidence of value of that pilot and really help us understand whether our assumptions were accurate, right? And so there's only so much you can do in terms of rubricing and so on. At some point, you need to create a mock or a prototype and have a user react to that. And if the value is strong, then you know you need to lean in. But if it's mediocre, right, then you also need to know that you pivot. And we created a ton of templates. So on the tactical level, right, we created the operational structure, we communicated that, we documented that, we set up all the meetings and so on. We also created a ton of templates for the teams to use so no one felt overwhelmed. And we were really finding out the tolerance of what people felt is helpful and what people felt might be bureaucratic. And that certainly you always have people... You have people who find it's helpful and other people who find it's bureaucratic. And so you're sort of like, okay. So we did do a lot of the things, and we use the label optional quite liberally look, you know, if you feel you can go ahead without this and you can still articulate well in that product review setting that this has value, you don't have to, right? We recommend you do, but you don't have to.
That's lovely. I always have this, it's a typical balance when you use templates that, there's twofold, kind of, as you said, bureaucratic, but also falling into the other side of the trap, like people, like zombies, kind of filling in the blanks and not really thinking through it. So that's another challenge. But when you make it optional and it's more about the thinking process than the tool, then it's worth by use. I have one very important question to that. What you can share about the rubric, because I think that this fits into what I was asking before about the selection, because you mentioned, hey, we have these tons of opportunities, these tons of ideas that we can set. You explain how we are kind of going through the pilot mode of testing them. But in the middle, you have the rubric, which may be a sort of selection, right? You are kind of, as you said, you are giving the strategic context for the teams to select what pilots might be worthwhile. So what can you share about that?
Yeah, that's sure. I can share. This is certainly to be found in other frameworks and other places as well. So this wasn't very specific in that sense. But I think it was a good formula because it's simple, but it was very effective. And so the first one was clearly the side of value. And on the side of value, we had a set of dimensions. One was the value of this change or that intervention, whether that's a small feature or that's something more significant, the value per individual user. And so we looked at it and said, okay, what if a user goes to this experience and gets this learning intervention? What is that sort of spectrum of value that we could generate for an individual user?
Can I interrupt you with that?
Sorry. Yeah, no, go ahead.
So how I actually measure this sort of, because learning is very tricky in that sense. How are you measuring that someone learned?
No, that's true. So on the measurement side, we have a host of metrics that we're using, and it's a hierarchy. And so I'll come back to the rubric and I'll give you orthogonal explanation here with regards to metrics. So the metrics are pretty standard at the bottom of that hierarchy. So certainly we have reach, which is how many people do we reach. And then we have engagement, which is how many people actually opt into our experience and engage with it. And the North Star, the engagement can come in multiple flavors, and that's highly specific to the features we're building. But then the North Star is time spent on quality learning resource. And that really is the last thing we can effectively measure as an input goal, which means we have control over, we can directly see effects from the product and feature experiences we're building. Yeah. And then we have the jump into impact. Yeah. And impact is the behavioral side of the world, right? This is where you have long-term effects of someone actually learning something. Yeah. Now, impact can come through surveys. It can come through, thumbs up, thumbs down type of things. In some experiences, it can be more near term. We have things where, was this learning resource helpful, right? And you can get some of that signal back. But for internal, we also have a more advanced set of metrics we can leverage. Now, those are closely tied to people essentially using Google's products, and they do include things like coding productivity and such. Now, they're lagging. And so they're all tracked and aggregated in a privacy safe way. So typically that data is a couple of weeks old when you would get access to it. And they're also lagging in the behavioral sense, right? Like people exposed to the learning resource would show certain effects only a little bit after. And so that's also what we do. So if people use our tools and we detect certain patterns of behavior we're interested in, we can overlay the touch points on learning resources and essentially create or derive insights from that data set around, if people interacted with this feature, did we see a change in a behavioral outcome metric or outcome goal we care about? But these are more long-term studies. So unfortunately, in learning, that is really the challenging part. it doesn't quite work as well as with some of the other products, which is, oh yeah, they purchased, right? but yeah, that's the nature of the game.
Yeah, I recently moved to kind of being, you know, an e-commerce site to teaching product management, so I totally can relate to that thing.
Yeah, but I do have to say, we do one thing that I think cuts through that challenge a little bit, which is actually a common tactic in digital marketing. We create panels. We create panels of individuals that are really a sample of our core user base. And they opt into an experience that's A, more tracked, like they install an extension, for example, and they opt into that type of tracking. And they're also opting into giving us signal quicker, right? And that, and that certainly can include signals of learning in a sense that, you know, this is something that people can self-report.
Yeah.
Pretty objectively, right? So if you feel, oh, this experience was good, it really taught me something new, people recognize that fast because, you know, it's new, they hadn't known it before. And it's not necessarily something you need to just derive from circumstance in the professional context where people really have a task, they really care to understand stuff. The self-reporting is typically a pretty okay thing to do. And so panels are one way for us to shorten the distance from these behavioral effects to the things we can measure more directly.
Yeah, perfect. Okay.
Come back to the rubric.
From the tangent. Yes.
So the first thing we had is value per user. And I think the second thing that's also part of the measurement is essentially just the volume of users we can reach. And there we look at total addressable market, which is how many people go through a certain experience and how many people do we think could benefit from the overlay of supporting a learning journey as part of that experience. And so when we think about people writing code at Google, for example, okay, how many people do that? How many people submit code for review? And if we were to consider a learning intervention as part of that flow, what is the conversion rate that we would want and what total number would that come to? There's one nuance there in terms of not just the distribution, but also sometimes the product experience, the learning experience is gated on the detection of a learning need, which might also reduce that number. So you take all the people writing code, you take all the people who submit code on a daily basis, which is a subset of the people writing code. And then you wonder about for how many of these people can we detect a moment of learning need? And that's, again, a subset of those individuals. And for how many of those people can we serve an effective learning resource in that moment of learning need? And that's, again, a subset, right? And then how many would convert? And you multiply that number with the value that we've mentioned in the previous statement. And so doing that analysis really helps us understand what is the ceiling here, right, on each of these levels. Because as a learning team, we can take responsibility for the effectiveness, the learning quality, the learning content, the matching, the detection mechanism. But we couldn't, for example, take accountability for how many people submit code for code review, right? That's outside of our control. And so that's how we then come to the number of essentially qualified reach times value per user. And that really constitutes for us value if, and we have a sort of factor in there that's a little bit in parentheses, which is the ability to automate or to programmatically serve that learning need through software.
Yeah.
Right. So you historically you've had been able to create these multipliers pretty liberally, but what wasn't quite in the mix was the fact that you always needed a human in some way in the loop in some scenarios. And so, or it was disproportionately hard to at some point of these steps to get from one to the next, and it required some manual intervention. And so clearly we added another multiplier here, which is, can this actually be served through a software solution? And if not, then that might be something for a program team, that might be something for a different team at Google, but it wouldn't necessarily be for our team because we're a team of PM and UX who are subscribing to building software to answer these learning use cases.
Good question to that. Is it a 0 to 1, so it's a binary indicator? Can we or cannot we? Or is there a degree of confidence?
There's definitely a degree. So clearly there is a 0 in there. So for example, some of the ideas were awesome, but they required net new content to be generated. And so that's quite close to 0, right? Yeah. Which is, okay, this all sounds great, but if we have to create new content, that's a huge manual effort. And so let's see whether we're prepared to staff that. And then in other cases, we had situations where it was more automated, but it wasn't quite the software that made the difference, right? We asked ourselves, okay, so we're essentially removing one click from a journey, or we're removing the need to go to the internal search engine, right, which does retrieve really good results for this topic, right? And so then you wonder, okay, is this something we really need to invest in? Is this more automation, or is this really something critical? And so you're trying to be diligent in that way. It wasn't 0 to 1, but it certainly did. It did come with a spectrum, but I wouldn't say it was too continuous. I think there are certain patterns in there, like someone needs to write the content. That was a big one. And then certainly there's this other thing about tooling built for or solutions built for people who then scale the effect of your solution. And so a good example of that is the tech writer community at Google, right? So if you were to make it much easier for tech writers to create content, would that have a multiplier effect for the rest of Google? Certainly there is something there. And the other thing is individuals at Google who are sharing that knowledge, like managers, for example, or tech leads, right? They are in a unique position. So if they understand the topic, they typically share it with their team and they share it with existing processes in place, right? So there's another dot on that 0 to 1 line, which is, should it be done in a way where we help some people to help a bigger group of people, right? And that second jump could actually already work. It could already be there. And so those are some examples of how we evaluated and thought about that multiplier.
I love it. I love it. I will go back to how we started the rubric question, because in the day I was talking about selection, but I think it's a bit more broader. So talking about, as you said, the filters to the pilots. Did you have any sort of additional layer of focus on the strategy, like saying, hey, we will we'll work with developers writing code or how we can help them, or we will help with technical writers writing documentation? Do you have some sort of umbrella topics for these pilots that were being created, or was just kind of free for all and teams can decide whatever fits this rubric?
Yeah, so we definitely had the first strategy was really to draw the circle as small as possible and then expand from there. But the expansion of a circle, like opening up another pillar, just like you said, helping tech writers help other people, right? Opening up that pillar was not part of the initial layout of this strategy, just because we were such a small team and the risk of spreading ourselves too thin was just so high. And so we did draw the circle narrower. Now since then, we've expanded those circles. We've created pilots for developers. We've created pilots for people creating content and managing content. We've created pilots for non-developer tech Googlers, for example, right? So we've since then expanded the strategy into other places. And we've also given it as a working model to the teams. Yeah. And so now it's not a central exercise anymore that is led centrally. But right now, every team that's executing, and I'm very proud of the team to have achieved that milestone, every team now starts to look at the space they own and wonder which parts have market fit and for which parts a pilot strategy might be the right strategy to deal with an elevated amount of uncertainty and complexity. And so they're coming up with their own principles. They're coming up with their own a version of those phases in the rubric and the selection criteria, and they're helping themselves in a way to come up with meaningful product ideas that ultimately stand the test of a review because they start asking those tough questions early.
Yeah, got it. So my next question is, how is this summarized? But in this case, maybe the way to formulate the strategy and to communicate it, do you think was more this kind of pilot program? So kind of explaining the pilot program itself and the steps in there and how we'll do things? Or was there any other artifact that you would say, hey, this is part of our strategy definition?
Yeah, no, definitely. So I can walk through the artifacts we used and also a little bit of the non-artifact pieces that were critical in landing this strategy. So the first one was a product strategy charter document. So that truly laid out the context, the reasons why, the principles, the phases, and really, almost sort of like a PRD for the product strategy, like a product strategy document really was what we put together. And that document was a living document for a while, but it was also a document that we knew mostly the council had to agree on and then put out there for input from others. But it wasn't sort of like, oh, everyone should collaborate, because we knew the team was not experienced in that way. And I think it would have been unfair to ask of the team to come up with this strategy, right? That is a lead's job in a way. And so we did that, and it became the center point of our approach. There was a corresponding deck. I always find it incredibly useful to communicate things visually and also through reviews. We had a ton of reviews and moments where we presented to the teams this sort of approach. Another host of artifacts were certainly the templates that came with it. Another host of artifacts were the ways we actually collected feedback from users, from people participating in all of this, right? So we had anonymous surveys, we had in-person meetings, we had AMA sessions, right? That was a big part of it. And then we had the artifacts around, the scoring and just essentially, where do pilots live? Where can I go and check in on the status of a pilot and so on? And, we created shared drives and all the other things. But that charter doc, that product strategy charter, that was really the core that we kept pointing back to in terms of like, look, here is why we chose this way.
Yeah. And one extra question to that, because you mentioned that it evolved over time. Did you have any kind of periodic review of that? So every three months or 6 months, we will review the charter, or was kind of stable document once you launched the project or the initiative?
Yeah, so it was stable within reason for, I'd say, 6 months after general agreement from council that these are the principles and so on. Now, there was still feedback coming in, but this was then more of the nature of explaining to people why these principles are and how they would work. After those 6 months, I think we did allow as you mentioned earlier, we did allow teams to create derivatives of that strategy and say, okay, I want this thing, but I also want to apply it to the space of, tech writers, for example, right? Or people creating content. And then we allowed to open that up. But the document still remains pretty much intact. And I do think to our luck, we did find pilots that indicated disproportionate value and graduated into what we refer to as core products, which are products that have long-term funding, which was the whole point of all of this, right? Is to find evidence of value that we can solve and help build successful products and software products in. And we did find that. So now it's sort of like the whole defending some of these principles is a whole lot easier, because now people see, oh, this is actually really working. And clearly, there's a spectrum of outcomes that could have occurred.
Yeah, that makes sense. All right, I want to be cautious of time, so I will ask my typical ending question, which is what I'm not asking. What's some interesting learning about strategy that you have either from this experience or past experiences that we didn't cover in these questions?
One thing that was a big learning for me is that when you do something like that and you own change, it's incredibly rewarding. It's also very hard. And one of the things that I learned during that episode, and I have to give big kudos to my manager here who helped me understand this, is some people pin the effect or feelings they have from that change against the person representing the change. And so there is an element in there as a leader to recognize that while it is being phrased personally, it is reacting to the change. And it is phrased personally purely out of circumstance because you represent that change. But it is reacting to the change, not reacting to you as a person. And I think that concept was incredibly helpful in terms of really being more empathetic to the folks that would go through a lot of that change, and also roles who are not as exposed to the change compared to product managers, right? Product managers always go through that change, and clearly, you know, for us, not taking things personally or not making it personal is something like that that we have to learn from the get-go. And sometimes I think that's a very powerful concept. So I certainly had a couple of moments where I was receiving messages and I felt, oh my God, like, am I the worst person in the world? And my manager helped me see that. And I was very grateful for, you know, receiving that input because it allowed me to really separate those two things from one another and also being way more empathetic to the individuals who went through that change and experienced what they felt was, you know, difficult and challenging, moments. And so I could also show up as a more helpful self, which again, I was very grateful for.
Yeah. My takeaway from that, from a strategy perspective, is that at the end of the day, this is change management, and some strategies, or many times strategies, will involve some drastic changes. For example, when you are reallocating resources or things like that. So having this in mind is quite important. I love that. All right, Stefan. This has been super useful and wonderful insights for everyone. Where can people find you if you want to be found? How can the audience help you?
Yeah, thank you. So people can find me on LinkedIn, obviously. People can also find my blog, theproductinsider.com. I write about my journey as a product manager. I write about the learnings I have as a product manager. There's an article on there. It's still on the main page. It's called Pilots, a Blueprint for Product Discovery. This is really a lot of what we talked about today is captured in there also. And people can get in touch with me through the website as well.
Love it. Love it. And we will make sure to link all of that. Once more, thanks for all the knowledge you shared today.
Thank you, Nacho. I appreciate it.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of 100 Product Strategies, the podcast by Product Direction. You can also follow us on Twitter, LinkedIn, or Instagram to get access to free weekly content that helps product people upgrade their skills and become more successful. You can access more material, promotional trainings, and be notified of every episode of the show with Product Direction's weekly newsletter. Join thousands of product leaders by registering in productdirection.co.